We share things with each other on the job that we don't share with our significant others or our families at home. If you can take any situation and instead of saying, why me, if you can replace that with, what am I learning from this? Or what am I supposed to get from this? What is it teaching me? You turn that whole situation around. But one of the things I did was I facilitated a peer support group for families and friends of first responders and veterans, because, you know, when that pebble falls in the lake, it's a ripple effect.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW EMT. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with certified peer support facilitator Denise Beard about moving forward in retirement from EMS. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. Our Facebook is Respond to Wellness, Inc. We're also on BBS Radio, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Our website is respondertv.com. We'll be right back to speak with Denise after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers. With vital information and resources, resilient strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW EMTB.
Today, we're joined by Denise Beard. Denise began her career in EMS in 1992, and in 2004 began working as a medical surgical assistant and later as a medical assistant in an oncology department. And in 2017, Denise, along with her husband, Peter, made the decision to retire and move to Canada. It was during her time in Canada that Denise began working with provincial and national organizations for peer support. Welcome to Respond to Resilience, Denise.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you, my old friend.
Yes. We've known each other a very long time.
How long have you known each other?
23 years this month.
Wow.
Yeah, we met in EMS.
Yeah, I was only 12, though, when we met.
I was born. So let's jump right in, Denise. We've had a lot of these talks along the years as friends, but to have you on the podcast and share your story with other people, I think is very powerful. What do you think draws us to EMS and why do we stay in it as long as we often do?
Everybody comes to something for a different reason. I think that studies actually have been done that show a large majority of the people that go into the EMS field are people who have very empathetic tendencies. So we tend to want to be the helpers, the fixers, those people that feel as though our cause is to help others. Mm-hmm. And in part, that's why we stay. The other reason that we stay is because within those first responder communities, whether it be police, fire, EMS, you become part of a family. When you think about it, especially when you're doing shift work, you're spending so much time with a group of people. And typically your partner is your partner is your partner. So you form these bonds with people that, we've been to each other's weddings, we're godparents for each other's children. We spend holidays together even when we're not on shift. So, it becomes so much a part of your life. Mm-hmm. That in a good way, but also in a bad way, mm-hmm. we tend to associate ourselves with not only the work that we're doing, but with that community of people that we're spending time with.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that bonding over that mutual struggling that we all do, whether it's personal, often professional, over the calls or being leaders together, it's during that struggling that our bond further deepens, right?
Absolutely. You know, we share things with each other on the job that we don't share with our significant others mm-hmm. or our families at home. You know, again, it's that protect mode. We want to protect the people we love by not exposing them to the traumas that we've been exposed to. Mm-hmm. In doing that, we tend to make things harder for ourselves, though, and make it worse. And it's something that we need to talk about, the fact that it's okay to talk about these things mm-hmm. and that maybe you don't share specific details, but it would be encouraged to be a little bit more open mm-hmm. about what you're going through.
So Denise, tell us a little bit about your EMS career. How long were you an EMT, and what was the process that led you to wind down your career?
So I started in 1992. I have a son who just turned 35 years old, who was born with severe disabilities. And that was in 1987. Mm-hmm. And after several years of, you know, 24/7 care, I realized there were a lot of things that, had I known at the time, I might have recognized some of the signs that there were going to be issues. And I never wanted to be put in a position of being that vulnerable again. So that was my decision to go into EMS mm-hmm. and learn whatever I could. The decision to leave EMS was very complicated. I actually didn't leave EMS until 2010. I worked with Bonnie at New Canaan EMS for a long, long time. My first husband, Bill, passed away in 2006 from pulmonary fibrosis. He was terminally ill for 5 years. And I continued on in EMS after that because that's where my support was. That was my family. That was partly who I identified myself as being. When I left EMS, it was at first a logistical issue. After my husband passed away, I was forced to move, and I had to move out of town. I moved about an hour away. And leaving EMS is one of the things that we'll talk about. You know, you have to really think about the fact that you're not just leaving a job, you're leaving a family. And how do we deal with that? You know, these are the people we spend the majority of our time with. For me, it was compounded with the fact that I had lost my husband. My two girls were moving on in their own direction. My son had to be placed into a group home. I was moved away from my community and my support system. I moved to a town where I didn't know anybody and tried to reestablish some kind of ties within that town that ended up not working out. And because my mental health started to deteriorate, I knew that it was time for me to step away and try to focus on myself and my mental health and my well-being for the good of my kids.
Mm-hmm. And I can kind of share this observation as a friend and a therapist, but I think because your husband was sick in the early stages and you had a child with a disability, you also cared for everyone around you.
Yes.
So much in that time. And EMS was another way you did that. Mm-hmm. And it seems like when you moved, you were able to really look at yourself and say, what do I do for me now?
That is true. That is true. I was able to spend a little bit more time focusing on me, mm-hmm. which was difficult. It was really hard. And after I met my who is my husband now, Peter, he actually was very instrumental in getting me to spend time not only looking at myself and what my needs were and how much I had given to other people, but what do I do moving forward? He was very, very instrumental in that.
And it says in your bio that not only were you an EMT, but also you worked in a medical profession where no doubt you were also being called on to give care to people in cancer and other medical settings. Did you have any experience with compassion fatigue or empathy fatigue or burnout? And what was that like?
Yeah, I kind of jumped from the frying pan into the fire with that one. I'm not quite sure why I decided to go into oncology, but it took a toll. Mm. You know, when you're in EMS, you deal with tragedy and you deal with death and illness on a regular basis. For me, working in oncology, I was dealing with tragedy and death and illness and mortality, you know, 24/7. And it began to take a toll as well. And where I was, working at Danbury Hospital at the time in the oncology department. I was there when Sandy Hook happened, and our oncology department was right next to the ER, so we were put in lockdown, and there was, you know, military police with, you know, AK-47s or whatever they are. You know, it just became so triggering and so stressful. And one day I went home and Peter, we were not married at the time, but we were living together. And he said, "Just leave. This is making you sick. Just leave." And I did. I gave my notice. And the question was, what do we do next? And I said to him, you know, I lost both of my parents when I was young. His mother was gone, but his dad was still alive in Canada. Peter is from Canada. And I said, I think we should go and spend time with your dad, because if you don't do it now, you're not going to get the opportunity. That was 5 years ago, and his dad turns 93 next month.
And here you are back in the U.S.
Back in the U.S.
Can we go back to the EMS piece for a minute?
Sure.
And I know, you know, we're talking about retirement with a lot of our first responders, and it's a buzzword at the moment. And it's different for everybody. But for you, can you talk about that day that you woke up and realized, I need to move on? Because I could imagine having had that day myself. It hurts like nothing else hurts.
Sure. I'd gone back. Even after I moved, I was making the commute back to New Canaan to do my shift. Because I felt like I needed that support. A lot of the faces had changed. And I remember driving to work one day. I was on 84 and I kept thinking, you know, I could really easily just drive into that bridge abutment and I wouldn't have to worry about it after that. And really what grounded me was my kids, making sure that I needed to be there for them, especially for my son. So it was at that point I knew I needed to make some serious changes, and I knew I couldn't do it on my own. So I went to my doctor, told him what was going on. I had already been diagnosed with PTSD years prior to that. He put me in touch with a counselor, and I started the process of saying, I just can't do this anymore.
Thank you for being so honest about that. One thing we try to do a lot on this show is really be honest and mm-hmm. show the truth about what happens to people. And hearing your story, I know that other people listening will glean something from that.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people and a lot of clients that we see in our offices end up leaving because of that reason, mm-hmm. because they're not taught how to care for themselves along the way. You know, in the beginning, like when you started in the 90s, it was still that culture of just suck it up, like go on the next job, deal with it. And we didn't talk about it as much. And that has had its toll on generations of first responders. And talking about it here is shining a light on it.
Yeah.
So that maybe someone else doesn't have to feel the way you did on 84.
Yeah. I mean, my dad served in the military in Okinawa and in Korea, and he would never talk about it.
Right.
And again, it goes back to that mindset of, you know, you don't talk about your mm-hmm. weaknesses, but mm-hmm. what we need to do is remind people it's not a weakness. One of the big things that I push really hard for is that we need to stop referring to this as PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder. It's not a disorder. It's an injury. Mm-hmm. It's a work injury. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be treated like an injury. We need to recognize there's an injury. We need to know, you know, we teach people how to lift properly so they don't injure their back, mm-hmm. but we don't teach them how to deal with a mental injury. And that's really one of the things that needs to happen. And in terms of retirement, there was actually a study done in Australia. There was a paper written on it. And it talks about the fact that we need to prepare our first responders for retirement by talking about it beforehand, by talking about the fact that you're not just leaving a job, that you're leaving a community, a support system. And how do you try and maintain some of those communications and contacts afterwards so that you don't fall into that abyss?
Mm-hmm. Do you think that for some retired people, maintaining the contacts or the relationships is a trigger in and of itself?
I think that depends on the individual and the relationship. You know, if you've got a healthy relationship with somebody, then
yeah.
You know, if it's not a healthy relationship, then it's probably not a relationship you want to maintain anyway. But
right.
Sometimes that's hard to decipher.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would imagine if you're feeling compassion fatigue or even betrayal trauma, which a lot of first responders have as well, unfortunately, I would imagine that sometimes maintaining those connections or even reach outs by certain people may be triggering. And may further push you from being in touch with your organization or your prior family.
It did for me. You know, when I left, again, I didn't have a choice in having mm-hmm. to leave in terms of the location. I had to move. I mm-hmm. couldn't afford to stay in the area. But when you talk about, you know, the feeling of betrayal, there was a real sense of out of sight, out of mind that, because I was no longer with that group of people, those people that were my supports, that they had moved on. You know, I wasn't there, so I wasn't somebody they had to worry about any longer. Mm-hmm. And that was very difficult to come to terms with, because you start to realize, if I'm going to do this and I'm going to get better, I've got to do it on my own. You know, yes, I need help, you know, externally, mm-hmm. but I can't depend on the people I thought I was going to depend on to make this happen.
If I can share my experience and help just one person, or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
We're trying to break down the stigma. We're trying to share that there are great, effective resources out there.
Vulnerability is a strength. It's not a weakness.
What I've heard from all of the subjects in my film is that I think my story can help someone else.
And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person.
This sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability. And I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
In terms of taking care of yourself, what kinds of things did you do for self-care and to kind of build up the parts that had been burnt out and worn out by all this giving that you had done in such medical professions?
That's a tough one because it was very difficult to transition away from that. I kept trying to find things that I thought were going to make me happy. But by making me happy, that meant I needed to do something for somebody else. So
I know what that feels like.
It started slowly. It started actually when my husband first got sick in 2001, my partner at the time gave me a gift certificate to go get my nails done. I was almost 40 years old. I'd never gone and gotten my nails done before. And she said to me, you know, you're going through a lot right now, and you need to take, if it's once every 2 or 3 weeks, you need to take an hour and just do you. And that was that was a long time ago. And every 3 weeks or so, I go get my nails done, even to this day. I began just doing a lot of internal thought, you know, not so much why is this happening to me, but what exactly is happening and what am I supposed to be learning from it? And that came from not only speaking with professionals, but I started doing a lot of reading on the subject. And if you can take any situation and instead of saying, why me, if you can replace that with what am I learning from this or what am I supposed to get from this? What is it teaching me? Mm-hmm. You turn that whole situation around and it becomes a learning opportunity and gives you an opportunity to decide what direction am I going to go into?
Right.
It's more empowering, right? You're not in sort of a victim role with yourself, yeah, of like, these things happen to me, but it's recognizing these things happen to everybody. All kinds of things happen to everybody. And it's how you respond to them, how you decide to integrate them or move forward with them is.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, I moved to Canada. I was in a country I'd never really been in before. I didn't know anybody. I wasn't even a citizen. You know, what the heck am I going to do here? But sometimes you're placed where you're meant to be. Mm-hmm. And that's really what happened with me. And the pieces literally fell into my lap for me to move in the direction that I did.
Can you talk about what that direction was?
Yeah. So about 2 or 3 months into moving to Canada, literally everything, decided one day I needed a haircut. So I went and got a haircut. And I came out of the salon from getting my haircut, and it was this side street. It was called the Cathedral District, very artsy fartsy. And they were having a street festival. And I literally walked out of the door of the salon, and there was a gentleman standing there, very handsome, very, you know, had this uniform shirt on, black pants, gray shirt. And he was standing next to this car. And I walked up to him and I said, wow, tell me what this is about. And he said, well, my name is Julius and I represent I want to know about the car. This car was decked out in, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of Daniel Sundahl, who has become a good friend of mine. But he does graphic art basically about first responder and military genre. And this car was covered in his artwork. And that was the beginning of not only 2.5 years of me beginning work as peer support, but working with somebody who to this day I consider a tremendous friend. So I began working with OSI Ken, which is a provincial peer support organization, which has now gone somewhat national throughout Canada. And it was fantastic. Talk about a learning experience. And I went from not only dealing with physical injuries to mental injuries, but I was able to learn so much about myself and able to even look back at my own mental injuries and understand, oh, that's why I act that way. Or, oh, that's why I did that back then. Boy, that was really dumb. But
were you working with law enforcement, fire, EMS, or a combination? And exactly what did you do?
Yeah, so it was military, active and veterans, fire, EMS, police, RCMP, and tow truck operators, dispatchers, corrections officers. So, you know, we talk about first responders, but that first responder world really has evolved. You know, we don't think about tow truck operators and the fact that, you know, they're not trained to deal with some of the stuff they deal with when they go on these horrific scenes.
Yep. Or animal control operators or...
Yeah. So it started out me learning about peer support, becoming certified and going on to take all kinds of certifications, mental health first aid, suicide prevention through Canadian Red Cross, and then just making connections through that. I began facilitating conferences and bringing in speakers. And even if it was just a 1 day, 2 hour event, just trying to raise awareness, not only for first responders, but for their families and friends. So one of the things I did was I facilitated a peer support group for families and friends of first responders and veterans, because, you know, when that pebble falls in the lake, it's a ripple effect. And we have to remind each other that when we go through these issues, it doesn't just affect us, it affects everybody around us. Mm-hmm. And then I got involved with a national organization called Canada Respect Forum. And that was an organization that really was a networking opportunity for other organizations that provide services to veterans and first responders. So we were able to bring these organizations together on a regular basis and talk about what they were doing. Where are you finding difficulties? What kinds of programs are you offering? Maybe there's another organization that offers a similar program that's having a similar issue. You guys can connect and maybe mm-hmm. figure out a way to make it work better, or get your word out, you know, do some marketing stuff mm-hmm. together. So
what I find interesting is you used to do a lot of CISD and debriefings at our agency, and it's interesting how things come full circle.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the things that I'm really passionate about right now is we really need to go beyond doing a critical incident stress debriefing. Mm-hmm. We need to at least provide an opportunity for our first responders on an ongoing basis while they're working mm-hmm. to have access to peer support. And if we can do that for them while they're working, then there's no reason why they can't continue that if they retire. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was doing this back in Canada, it didn't matter whether you were active or retired in whatever field it was, you were welcome at the table. Mm-hmm. And for those people who were still active, it really did make a difference in their being able to process some of what they were going through.
I unloaded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
You know, I could jump in. We happen to run a group just like what you're describing through our trauma team, and it's a free group every Friday. We've added, it's so successful, we've added another one on Tuesday nights. And we have people from all branches, like you mm-hmm. said. And it is great because there are active people, there are retired people. And I think for a lot of the retired people that join, they're able to find a connection and maintain that connection. So there's so much benefit to that peer support. And I know that with the new legislation in Connecticut and some of the other states, they're mandating peer support. It's already happened in Connecticut for police and fire. And I'm hoping EMS is on the next voting block for that. Which we've advocated for in our group as well. But if it's mandated, then it has to get done, which is a good thing, I think, for all of us.
I think that's great. But I also think that the employer needs to understand that they have an obligation.
Yeah.
You know, every employer is obligated to provide a safe work environment mm-hmm. And do whatever they can to avoid injuries on the job, right?
Mentally and physically.
Well, and that's my point. They're willing to do it, and they've been mandated to do it for physical injuries. But maybe they need to just step up and do it, mandated or not, mm-hmm. to avoid these operational stress injuries.
Right. I think you're right, and I think we're on the cusp of that changing. And yes, some will do it because it checks a box on a nice paper for the state. But around here, we're seeing a lot of good change with that. And some departments, even companies that provide EMS staffing, starting to be proactive and offer these kinds of support groups before the mandate's out. So yeah. I think we're on the cusp of the change that you're talking about and that we all want to see. And the more we talk about it and the more people that hear this message on shows like this, the more buy-in I think ultimately we're going to have.
Well, and the reality, too, is that as generations move on, mm-hmm. you know, and the younger generations like yourself, mm-hmm. I can say that because I'm older, but the younger generations that are getting this information now, as they come into play and they take on management roles, mm-hmm. they're going to be more willing to be open to these kinds of opportunities for their employees and for the people that they manage.
Definitely.
Well, looking back on your experience in Canada and your experience in the U.S., did you find that they do some things differently or better in terms of peer support or just, you know, generally in the culture of the responder support? Were things that you just learned in Canada that you'd like to share?
I can't say that they do things very differently there or that they do things better. I think it really comes down to the individual and the supports that they have access to and that are around them. And the more support that we can provide and the more support that we can make available, whether it be being able to join a Zoom call. You know, if you're out in a rural area and you can't get to where the meeting is, you know, the more access people have, the easier it's going to be for them to be able to find whatever it is that they need. And that's really the juxt of everything. I just recently moved to Florida and we moved into a retirement community.
You are older than me.
55 plus. I barely make it. But one of the things that I'm looking to do now is to start a support group within that community. And whether that expands outside of that community or brings people into the community for it, that's on my list of things to do. My support organization is called Dragon Heart, Heart of a Dragon, Soul of a Phoenix. And I will share information with you and Bonnie once I've got the website up and running. And you are welcome to spread the information. And anybody that wants to is more than willing to, or more than welcome to come and join.
That's great. It's been one of the good things of the pandemic. We use Zoom a lot more now. And we're able to have people join even our group from around the country. So that's wonderful. We will definitely promote it. And when you get that up and running, come back on here and talk a lot more about what that looks like.
Oh, it'll be fun.
Well, Denise, anything else that we didn't cover you'd like to speak about?
Oh, so many things. No, I just, Bonnie can tell you that from the time she's known me, I've always said, communication, 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 anything that's going to happen, any change that's going to be made, anything that's going to be made better is going to get done through communication. And whether that's giving people access to information, teaching them, providing it, that communication is so key. And communication within our small communities, within our families, again, it's that ripple effect. We're not isolated when these things affect us. They really do affect everyone around us.
Well, I love the fact that you're starting or running a peer support group in a retirement community, because I'm sure there's going to be so many people that want to connect, but also going through their own identity crisis. It must, you know, how difficult it must be for anyone to shift from an active work life and having the identity of doing whatever your profession is to I'm retired and I'm now, you know, don't have to show up for work and I don't have that responsibility, but I'm also not needed the way I was before. So I'd love for you to keep in the loop, keep us in the loop and let us know how that's going. And I'm sure you'll have some great stories to share.
I hope so.
It amazes me how, especially when you get a group of retirees together, you talk about how we all just love to be in the thick of it. You know, that's one thing I think we all have in common one way or another. You know, we love running into that chaos, and being able to learn how to live without that chaos is healthy for all of us. And so it's just always interesting.
It's a new support group right there, Living Without Chaos.
Chaos, yeah. It's actually funny. I had in our new house, we just celebrated Christmas in our new home, and we had 12 or 13 people there. And someone said to me, you know, you look so calm, and there's just chaos everywhere. There was like, you know, children screaming and people running. And it reminded me of my days working in EMS, especially as, you know, lieutenant or captain or whatever, when, you know, I was trained to stand back and just take a look at the big picture before you walk in. And
yeah,
that's what I was doing on Christmas Day. I was just standing back and watching the chaos, but you know, I was there if anybody got hurt. So
you're formulating the incident plan, and
she's the manager of the chaos.
Well, great. Thank you, Denise, for being with us and sharing your story and all the things that you're creating. And We look forward to hearing more as that evolves.
Thanks for joining us, Denise. It's been personally and professionally very rewarding.
It's been a pleasure, and I applaud what you and David are doing.
Thank you.
I want to invite everybody to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website with past episodes and guest information is ResponderTV.com. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.